the way that my body is balanced, my mind is telling me like three different things that I could do. You know, maybe I need to get a left heel hook or right, a far right smear, just anything to get my hips up and to the left. And so, you know, two or three things run through my head, but I got to try one of them, and I try it and I fall. And if you fall and you immediately go to, oh, I can't believe I just fell, like that was my chance, like I don't know if I can get back up there again. If you go to this frustration, you're going to forget what your body was telling you when you were on the wall. Whereas if you're not worried about falling, if you don't take it personally, then you fall and you start to analyze.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. All right, Tim, my dude, we have an Olympian on the podcast, and not just an Olympian, but a climbing Olympian. Yeah, a climbing Olympian, and not just a climbing Olympian, but a silver medalist climbing Olympian. Is that how you say that? Yeah. And hold on, Tim, hold on. Not just an Olympic silver medalist, but someone who has also FA'd a V16 before. You might have heard it. Maybe even you climbed on it, Tim. It's called a Grand Illusion.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Nathaniel Coleman, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast, man. We are welcome, so excited. Really are.
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
So obviously, Nathaniel, the question on everyone's mind is, how did you get so good at Kendama? Yeah, yeah. Kendama, that was really listener questions. Boone Speed brought it up. So, you know, that's what we're here today to cover. I mean, what is it? Am I pronouncing it right? Like, what? Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, you got it right. Kendama. Yeah, it's a skill toy made in Japan, like hundreds of years old. But it, for some reason, in the last like 30 years, it really caught on worldwide, and they started having like international competitions. And I was introduced to it through my buddy Dave Burleson. He was dating a girl who played with a kendama, and as soon as we picked it up, we just got obsessed. It's like, it's one of those things that when you see somebody good do it, you're like, oh, that's not that hard. Like, there's a cup maybe like the size of a silver dollar, and a ball, you know, a little smaller than a tennis ball, and you just gotta catch the level one is catching the ball in the cup, and it looks really easy, but I've never seen anybody flash it. And so
really,
yeah,
the first time ever.
Yeah. Just the easiest trick. I've never seen it flashed. So it's really tough, but, I've started playing that when I was like probably 18 or 19 and just played a little bit here and there, took some breaks, got super heavy into it, but now it's been like 6 years and I know enough to impress the layman with the kendama.
Kendama's like yo-yo in a lot of ways, where it's like essentially a very simple tool, like a very simple toy, and you can do like the most absurd tricks on it. Like the kendama that you see nowadays on like, I don't know, reels or like people who are really good at it, it really is like a totally insane sport.
I know.
And the reason why I brought it up on the meet and greet, I was just like, yeah, we got to ask Nathaniel about kendama. And Josh was like, what's kendama? Like, why? When? Why? I was like, because the first time I like went, you know, was going to competitions and like saw a different, like, I don't know, a mental tool or like a tool for relaxation was Nathaniel using kendama. Like people were using hacky sacks and like doing, you know, games, cards, like a lot of people did cards and stuff. And I was like, I think mechanical things, like really, really, really simple mechanical things look really like therapeutic, really focusing. And it was so clear. Like I was telling Josh, I was like, I would literally see Nathaniel like in the chair, just like serious like kendama-ing, and I was like, that's insane, man. Like, And it worked. Like, it seemed like it worked. But also, like, obviously, it was so funny because over the next couple of years, I saw so many more kendamas in competitions, like in ISO, in climbing competitions. Yeah. It was hilarious. Like, so many more people embraced it, right? Like, yeah, you definitely started a little wave where people were like, oh, wow, this is sick. But then people just started liking kendama, I think. So
yeah,
maybe
yeah.
Removed from that. But yeah, super interesting.
I think a lot of climbers had like played with them like back in junior high. And then when they saw me doing it in isolation, and by the way, I do it in isolation because it's a great warm up. It gets your blood flowing, you get your whole body moving, and you also get your like hand eye coordination really dialed. But yeah, when they saw me playing with it, they kind of saw, oh, throwback, like I'm gonna pick my old one up. And yeah. Wait, it goes well with climbing.
So you're like in ISO, like doing, are you like in between boulders while you're competing, like just kind of playing with it? Like, yeah. How do you actually
mostly it's a pre-wall warm up. So before I start climbing, this is just how I get my blood flowing, how I kind of like focus on something. And so I have been known to play with it in between boulders of competitions. Just to like take my mind off the competition, I guess. But yeah, I don't do that often.
Well, you know, we actually didn't bring it up in the meet and greet, Tim. You told me about afterwards. I thought it was hilarious. Totally surprised him there. But I actually thought it was interesting because I guess for me, Nathaniel, I mean, you know, I listed out your impressive bio to start it out. But when I thought about you as a climber and, you know, just kind of what always struck me as the thing that really stood out is your like your mental game. And like, you know, that's kind of like an amorphous topic, but I would always hear about how, you know, like Nathaniel did okay in qualifiers, did like okay in semis, and then you smashed finals. And, you know, this is kind of like a topic we tackle a lot on Test Pieces, this kind of mental side. And I was like, what an interesting thing that you are. It's like, okay, what does the mental master do to prepare like for coming out in the final stage? He's like, oh, he's playing with this little toy. And you know, I mean, we can go into that, but I guess it just is kind of a broader question around, you know, what is ISO like for you? What do you think about when you step out on the mats or is it about kind of not thinking so much and kind of, you know, just executing?
Yeah. I'll tell you about some of my first open national championships, because I think that was where my mental game that I had been developing for, you know, 8 to 10 years at that point, where it really like came to blossom. I feel like when you're first stepping out onto a big stage, like open nationals, it's like so exciting and so nerve wracking at the same time. Anytime you like increase the level of your competition, you're going to, your mind is going to start going crazy. You know, you're like, oh, I've never competed against these people. Like this is the biggest stage. It means the most, you know? And so I think that I was just really good at converting those nerves into excitement, because there's such a fine line between being nervous and being excited. And I don't know what the difference is between the two sides. But I don't even know exactly how I switched from one side to the other, but I think that a big help for me was being honest with myself in my emotional state. What was I like nervous about? What was the worst case scenario? Am I going to be okay with that if that happens? And once I come to terms with, you know, the worst case scenario, then it's like, okay, even if I fail, it's not going to be that bad. And then I was able to start to look at it in the positive light. You know, what's the best case scenario, and start to do the dreaming. And as soon as you start dreaming about being on the podium, or taking the W, it starts to like fill your whole body with this like excitement and like warm feeling. And that's the best place for me to be. And, And I think that that's really good preparation for before the round. And then once you get started climbing, I would notice that between all the boulders, I really was thinking about not a lot. I was maybe reminiscing on some like highlights of the last boulder, but I would try to move on from that and start focusing, start thinking about the next boulder. Because, you know, we had had time to do the route preview. And, but mostly it was just like, you know, looking around, maybe making some jokes with some of the other people in there. And, you know, it also helps when you look around and you realize everybody else on that stage is nervous as well. You know, it sucks if you look around and everybody's chill and you're like freaking out, but, yeah, just good friends and, I think appreciating the moment that I was in really helps as well.
Dude, I gotta like talk about those first open nationals. Cause those were the first ones that I competed in as well. For my first, you're 26, 27,
26. Yeah.
So you're 2 years older than me. And when I first started competing in open, I was also like, I came from maybe competing for like only a couple years or climbing for a couple years. And I remember like watching you compete and I was like, I kind of knew that you had a pretty long youth career too. That was like relatively successful.
Yeah.
I don't know like what the placements were, but like, it was clear that you had already competed well and you already had like good climbing technical ability. And watching those comps, it was interesting. It literally was what Josh was saying, where it was like, qualify, like, all right, whatever, like Nathaniel's a good climber, and then semifinals, like, yeah, whatever, like Nathaniel made it to the final. And then there was, I think, three nationals in a row that I watched where you flashed all of the finals boulders, and two of them, there was two back to back.
I think
was
two
three in a row.
I think two.
There
and
was
then
two,
and then the third one, Sean Bailey flashed all the boulders and I fell
right
once.
And you fell once.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Dude, it's crazy too, that. Because man, those like, man, we were watching those live. They were in these crazy convention centers and the setting was amazing. Like I thought the setting was amazing at those competitions. Like some of the best competitions I had ever watched, period. I think just the energy, the types of people you were competing against, like the different styles of competitors, you know, people were just going for it. Like it did seem like people were doing pretty well at emulating the same mindset that you were saying that you had, which I kind of want to speak on that as really interesting that it's, you know, when you really listen to really high level athletes talk about and break down their mindset or like simplify a process, it is way simpler than you would expect it to be, you know? And I think that's actually the point, is like, it's so hard to be simple-minded in competition. It's so difficult because you're right. It's the excitement. It's the anticipation. It's like the what ifs. It's all those things. And when those come crashing down on you, you know, what I've experienced in myself and like coaching other athletes who usually struggle with it are that those things are more important than the simple task, right? Right. Like obviously if you're a good climber, like that's the best place you can be is like in flow. Mm-hmm. And like, yeah, that's totally what I watched, man. Like it was crazy. Yeah, if anyone had watched any of those like finals in open, like those are still some of my favorite live moments to watch in climbing. Just like, how did you not fall? Like the style was insane too. Like it wasn't easy climbing. You know, some people would just never top these things and be like, wow, like there would be a boulder literally where no one would top and Nathaniel would come out and flash and be like, what is going on? It was the craziest things to watch, man.
Yeah, those were glory years.
Yeah, I mean, it was really interesting to me where what you said was being honest with yourself. Like there's something about that that is really interesting. Then you kind of talked about this fear setting idea. I call it fear setting, where you ask yourself, well, what's the worst that can happen? And then you ask yourself, what's the best that can happen? And it's interesting because I actually think that that's maybe like the level one that you exhibit of a good mental state, where you kind of just show up and you kind of calm those nerves. And I love what you said about turning it from nervousness into excitement. Like I could think about in the podcast, I'm like, oh, I'm going to interview an Olympian. Or it could be like, I'm going to interview an Olympian. You know, it's like, it's the same thing, but like, you know, how are you putting it together? And, you know, something you said on another podcast that I listened to that really struck me, and I'm going to just make this up and call it level two, but I think this is something that would be really fun to dive into, is you were talking about your speed round in the Olympics and you talked about your leg power. And you're like, oh man, I got more leg power than I'm used to. And you said that you mentioned to your coach, like, man, like, got some leg power that wasn't there before. And, you know, when you pulled that apart, you said something along the lines of, well, I mean, I'm in the Olympics, I'm excited. And, you know, you're putting that extra excitement. And so it's interesting because what I first hear you say is, it's like, okay, nationals, open stage, really exciting, need to tamp down those feelings. You know, you just need to like show up and climb. But then the next level is,
yeah.
Oh, wow, I got extra feelings. I got extra power. I can put this to use. And I don't know if you can speak on that and your tactics for doing that. That's always a little amorphous, but that was really cool to hear that. And I just, you know, would love to hear about that experience.
Yeah. I think that is, I think an important part of that situation is the difference between speed climbing and bouldering. And even we can talk about lead climbing. And this will be something that I learned from a sports psychologist that works with the US Olympic Committee, actually. So she sat the whole US team down and she said, on a scale of 1 to 10, what excitement level do you like to be at before you go out to do boulders? And I think the average for all of us was like a 5 or a 6. You know, you don't want to be at a 10. You don't want to be super jazzed because you're going to be shaky. And then she asked, okay, what about for lead? And the average, I think, was around like a 3. You want to be like pretty chill before you're going out to a lead route. And then for speed, it was like somewhere up around like a 7 or an 8. You still don't want, you don't want to be at a 10 because, you know, there is fine muscle control. But so, yeah, I think in speed climbing, definitely there's more room to harness that nervous energy and convert it into power. I would say more room than bouldering, although there are some boulders where you really just need to get that full power going. But
that's so interesting. I definitely like have found like sometimes I'll struggle because I'm too excited or too not enough excited for boulders. And that is an interesting thing to think about, like your kind of natural state. I think I generally will walk towards climbs with a very high state of like excitement or arousal. Like mm-hmm. I would have counted myself at like a 7 or 8 almost every time, but mm-hmm. also for lead as well. I just like calm down as much as I can, like right before I go.
Yeah.
Cause it's like, excitement's like the hard thing to put back in. Like, you know, when you're like focused and like you come in kind of tranquil and you're like, oh, like that's again, something that I thought was amazing about you was like how quickly you could go from 5 to 9, right? Like, and that was just, I think, just something to take, kind of like take note, like as you're going into comps, like, all right, I'm going to be out of 5, but might need to get to a 9. And like, I would always say very stagnant in my excitement level, like, all right, whatever we go out and do, like when I was really bad at it, I would like go out and be like, all right, like, let's just get really stoked. And then I wouldn't listen to it. I wouldn't think about why it was relevant or like how it applied to the climbing necessarily. Like that stuff's hard to really, you know, break apart when you're competing because you're really focused on like, mostly the absorption of things, right? Just like, oh, like new holds, like new moves, like how am I supposed to figure this out? How am I supposed to commit? And I think when those things can calm down, like when those things can just like, okay, we don't have to think about that stuff necessarily. Like what we should think about is like our state of mind. Like when I started changing my thinking to that, man, it became so much more just like clear. Losing was easier. Like walking away, like unable to do a boulder was a lot easier because I was like, I don't know, I'm just going to do my best, you know, like I'll try to pay attention more and just like do my best versus like kind of predestined, you know, like that. This is for me, like when it gets difficult, I'm just sharing like, you know, when it doesn't work out so good, like, you know, that's kind of what happens is actually like, it's so interesting to hear you say like, again, simple things, pretty simple things that just like are actually relevant. Like those things that you're saying are actually relevant to the exact thing that you're doing. And there are so many distractions and comps and like so many different things. And like, you just have to be able to navigate those things. Super cool. It's super cool just to hear you talk about it.
Yeah, I'll tell you something that you might appreciate. You might be able to put into future use. The sports psychologist, she also told us a technique to elevate your excitement level if you're not high enough, and a technique to lower it. And they're both centered around breathing. The way to lower it is you just take a 5-second breath in, hold for 5, 5-second breath out, hold for 5, and repeat that. And it was actually something that I employed right before my send go on Grand Illusion. I was like,
wow.
I had showed up to the boulder, like warmed up really nicely. And then I was about to take my first ground rip and I was like really nervous and excited. And I tried to wait it out, but it wasn't really going down. And I took a rip. I like fumbled a couple of the holds on the bottom crux, got through the bottom crux and then just dropped off. I was like, this is not the go. And recentered, did the breathing technique, got into like a perfect level of excitement for the boulder, and then fired it next go. So I can testify That's that awesome. It works. I can testify that it works. And then the way to get your heart rate up, I'm not 100% sure that I'm remembering this correctly, but I'm pretty sure it was like some form of hyperventilating. So just quick breath in and out. Not for too long because you'll pass out, but yeah.
Yeah. We talk about it. I think the rule of thumb is if your exhale is longer than your inhale, it calms you. And if your inhale is longer than your exhale, it excites you. And, I think that's so cool hearing you do it before Grand Illusion, you know, cause I think people sometimes hear about this stuff and think, oh, that's nice. Like, oh, like that would be cool. But then, you know, using that to your advantage, and also that idea of the different excitement levels and how you never said 10, I thought was really interesting. Yeah. It's never, I mean, look, well, I'm actually, even in like the most burly single moves, it's never quite 10 because you have to coordinate. You have to do things in this coordinated manner. I just,
technical,
that's like,
still,
it's just fascinating to hear. Like you think, you know, you see someone like Nathaniel who's burly doing big burly moves, you go, oh dude, that's, you know, just absolute try hard. And it is, but not in exactly the way that people expect. And I love hearing you break that down. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. I want to, breath work. What you're talking about is super interesting. I do see you breathe a lot before and after climbing, and just like in general, I can see it's like present in your climbing. I use a lot of breath work in my climbing as well, but in a totally different way. Like anyone who's listened to the podcast or like has been coached by me, breath work is one of the very first concepts that we go into, because I think it's a really easy way to direct your body. Like it's a really simple, everyone can do it. It's really easy to learn. Like literally it's human. Like it's a very human thing. It's not related to climbing or anything. It's just human. And very few people do it. Very, very, very few people do it. Like I think it's a fundamental thing in climbing and sports. And like I watch so many high level competitive climbers not breathe. It's crazy to me. But you know, the breathing, and like I said, I see you do that, but the breathing before is something that I definitely like would just do if it felt right. Like, you know, definitely like some levels of excitement I would fix, but I definitely personally, if I ever go and compete or like try to go for a send or something, I for sure am using breaths like before my climbing.
Yeah. That's interesting to hear. I've definitely noticed like my breathing while climbing and, but I've never really thought about like the why or the how I learned it behind it, you know. But definitely like before you prep for like a big extension move, you kind of pop, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah.
I like how that sound and that look you just made. I was like, oh yeah, I know that. It just like looks so well, you know, along these lines is still, you know, the mental game and what it's like to be out there and perform. You said that your mind, I don't want to say goes blank, but you said something along those lines when you're executing between boulders, you know, it's like, you're kind of just there, you know, just there. And, this is only going to apply to bouldering, because it's only one where falling actually happens. I know falling doesn't seem to happen too often to you, but, what is your self-talk? Just being nice, just being truthful, man. I remember all those, flashing at nationals and it was always like, is it going to flash this one too? Anyways, like we said, who's counting? I'm curious, what's your self-talk like when you do fall, and what's your process like? You know, I'm sure your mind isn't blank when you fall. It's not like, oh, I guess I'm just going to do the exact same thing and then hope for a better outcome. Like, I know that's not what you're doing. It's not just like, oh, I guess I got unlucky that time. Like, let's hope next time's better. So if you can talk us through kind of your self-talk when you fall, and then how you either get over that self-talk or use it to your advantage, and how you break down a fall and how you accomplish a better go on the next try.
Yeah. So something that I think I was really good at when I was like 18, and I think it's something that I've kind of struggled to hold on to as I've gotten older, is this pure focus while you're climbing on intuition. And I guess it's not even a focus on intuition, but just climbing like intuitively. When you're doing that, and I'm thinking of like World Cup boulders, like specifically right now, when you're doing that on World Cup boulders, it's definitely not uncommon to break the beta or to do unintended beta, which is like a nerve-wracking thing for a competitor to do. But when I was younger, I would be in this like intuitive state, and let's say that I get to like a really difficult move, and the way that my body is balanced, my mind is telling me like three different things that I could do. You know, maybe I need to get a left heel hook or a far right smear, just anything to get my hips up and to the left. And so, you know, two or three things run through my head, but I got to try one of them, and I try it and I fall. And if you fall and you immediately go to, oh, I can't believe I just fell, like that was my chance, like I don't know if I can get back up there again. If you go to this frustration, you're going to forget what your body was telling you when you were on the wall. Whereas if you're not worried about falling, if you don't take it personally, then you fall and you start to analyze, oh, you know, that didn't quite work because maybe my rotation was not exactly what I was expecting. And so instead, I'm going to try this other beta that I was thinking. And then you have direction for your next attempt. And I think that's like, that's been something that...
Holy.
Yeah, that was so good. How good was that?
Put it, tattoo it on your... Dude, what? Like, that's so crazy. Like, it's... I did coaching and like just watching competitors a lot. Like, I really did feel like the ones who would struggle, like people who would struggle. And I noticed because I was like this as well. Like, the people who struggled are the ones who couldn't tell you what they just did on the wall. Like the ones who fell and like, you're like, yeah, what happened? And they're like, I don't really know. It's like, really? Like, you're like, dude, like obviously in comps, it's like more understanding. Like there's so much more emotion and frustrations that happen. But if you're not really paying attention to those things in your sessions, like you're totally right. Like you should be climbing intuitively most of the time, like super involved, super aggressive, like super hopeful, optimistic, just like, yeah, what's the, okay, like left, right, what's, okay, these things work. It's like, ah, like, okay, I made a mistake, but like, what was the mistake? Like, what exactly did I just do and what should I have done? Like, you cannot get to that point because of emotion. I think that was an interesting thing that you said. It's like, some people just don't pay attention, but the emotion can get in the way.
Yeah, what I found really interesting there is that I asked you, what was your self-talk? And there was no self-talk. It was don't think about your frustration. Don't think about it. Was think about how the move felt and then try to understand why you fell. And I guess just to like pick that even deeper, if you're willing to, because I'm not as experienced. I mean, I haven't competed in a long time. And when I competed, it was at a high level, but not that level. And maybe it was more straightforward. But let's say, you know, you went for the heel hook and then it blew. And like, how do you know when to not commit more to the heel hook versus be like, oh, I'm just going to go for that smear over there. And I'm sure this is the thing about climbing that's tricky, is every freaking time is different and every, but I don't know. I'm just because I got you on the pod, I'm just like picking you apart as much as I can.
What a good question, dude. Can I say just like in between both of this, like what the hell, like what a good answer and what a good question. Sorry. That was, what a good question. Like, all right, go for it, Nathaniel.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks. Yeah, that's a good question, and it's really difficult to answer. I think that when you're climbing, when you're like in your zone, it's easier for you to tell what your own like limits are, and it's easier for you to like envision you know, could I have done something better with the heel hook? And would that make enough difference to actually get me through that move this time? But if you're not in that flow zone, if you're not like climbing intuitively, then it becomes much more of like a logical breakdown. And I feel like that's something that I've been developing and like resorting to more in these last couple of years of competing. I've gotten way more like cerebral and strategic, and there are some benefits to that, you know, that comes from experience. And I've been in situations where that experience helps me outperform the less experienced but stronger and better climbers. So if you like try a beta and you fall on it and you can't really tell if that beta is worth pursuing, I always think about like, okay, what do I think is the intended beta from the root setters? Because if my first attempt I was climbing intuitively and I tried to cheat the beta, second attempt, I think it's time to give the root setters a chance and like try what I think is the intended beta. Because oftentimes it's the easiest way. If I had tried what I thought was the intended beta and it felt like not even close, man, it's just tough. It's just tough.
So good. No, that's so good.
Yeah.
I loved it. I think it's a great question, because the answer is, in my opinion, like when I see athletes do really, really well in this, it's actually a gamble. It's actually a risk. Like, I think the first steps are like, okay, you know your limits really well. Like really, really good athletes and really good climbers do know, like, once I've tried a beta, like how likely is it going to be that even this is going to work? And the likelihood is like there, it's existent. Like most movements that you try, if you're willing to even try it again, the likelihood is there, but the percentage is low, right? Like the percentage of that likelihood working in the next two or three tries, it's not high enough for you to solidly go for it, obviously, right? Because comps are just a matter of tries or flashes or minutes, right? And so if you're not 100% certain, of course you wouldn't try that again, right? And that's where it gets really tricky, is when like root setter intended beta and then your intuitive beta is too close. It's like when your thoughts are too close, where you're like, dude, like they're both likely, but they're both likely to fall, you know? And then when that happens, I really think that where I see climbers do really, really, really well is the most risky climbers, who are the most willing to just be like, whatever, it feels best this way. And you've done so much training, you've done so much work in this way, you've done so much awareness training to really be accurate, like accurate enough. Like, but that's what it takes, in my opinion, to win, is to like risk enough, be that loose, be that in flow, but also be that trained, like strong for sure physically, be really technically fit and like good in flow, and like being able to analyze and see these things. And then reactions, right? If your reactions are on point, then yeah, you should be competing intuitively. And then when you have a little bit of clarity and thought, like, you know, but in the correct way, like what you're saying, then I think you can like make choices. When you have really good choices and you have like a really good place from a good place, you know, from optimistic thought, and then it just worked out. Like it just worked out all the time on climbs that, you know, just like maybe didn't seem like you would flash, or like you weren't always picking like perfect beta, but like it was either perfect route setter intended beta, or it was either perfect intuitive beta, and it was just whichever one was like the better one for you. And it's like, what a perfect flow, right?
Yeah, but
that's my yeah.
No, I like the gamble analogy. It definitely feels like hedging your bets sometimes. And you know, the worst thing in the world is when you try your first beta and you're like, that's not going to work, and then you try your second beta and you're like, that's even worse. And then you go back to your first beta. It's like, what am I doing?
And then it works. Sometimes it works. And sometimes you're like, what am I doing?
Something that you said that was really interesting is this idea around route setters being, you know, trying to figure out what the route setters intended, right? Because theoretically that is the easiest way, which we know you can break it often. First of all, it just shows you how freaking important route setters are to our competitive sport. Like, just, we need to get more route setters on here, Tim, to talk to them. Anyways, side note, just, it really is important. And what made me think of is that you're in this somewhat, I don't want to say unique, but there's not that many people who have competed at US nationals a lot, World Cups a lot and the Olympics. And how are those competitions different? Like, how's the route saying different? The style, like when you, how are the stages different? Just, you know, yeah, just kind of curious what you think of the difference between all those.
Yeah. US route setting has changed a lot since I've started competing. I remember my first year in Open Nationals, they had like a hanging start, and then you'd have to like campus lache across to another hold. And it was like the most futuristic move that anybody in the US had ever seen. And that was the beginning of the US transition into more World Cup style route setting. And so today I feel like I would have a hard time putting like my finger on what US route setting style is, because it's no longer like good holds, big moves, which is what it used to be. And it's not quite as like weird and uncomfortable as World Cup setting can be. So yeah, Tim, I'd be interested to hear if you had any thoughts on that, but I'll also talk about my World Cup view real quick. I think qualifiers is what I do most in bouldering World Cups. And those are like the weirdest and the most uncomfortable. And it's the round that the route setters set last. So, you know, maybe they're a bit more mentally fatigued. And there's like wide variation in difficulty. Some boulders get flashed by more than half the category, and some boulders just never get sent. And so it makes for a really interesting stage for competitors, right? Semifinals are like the most difficult round. And that's where the route setters really do their limit testing. They're like, what are these athletes actually capable of? And then finals are, in my opinion, they're just mostly like showboat moves. You know, what's the newest hype on Instagram? Oh, let's do a 360 slab move. Yeah, sick. So, and then Olympics is just like an extension of World Cups, because it's all the same setters, all the same climbers. And yeah.
I think that the fascinating part about this question, and I actually don't really want to like, I've shared so many thoughts about, you know, where I thought, you know, whether it's on this podcast or like in different conversation, like, you know, route setting in general, I've had a lot of thoughts about route setting, because I do agree with you in that, like, it kind of did start off with more intentional things. I think route setting is amazing because it's a tool where we can create climbing movements, right? It's not like outside where you like go and find climbs that have holds that are objectively just like hard. You can adjust them. Like, you can challenge people to be like, well, you can do it this way, and let's turn this foot, you know, 20 degrees this way. And it changes the move entirely. And it makes you be more creative as a climber. And like, my theory in route setting, especially in competition, is that you can do that. You can create movement. You can create movements that are so weird and like don't make very much sense, but like are rooted from intuitive climbing movements. So they do make sense to read. And that's just how I see like really good competitions are movements that I can read very clearly as like a good rock climber who knows movement theory and like has studied enough rock climbing. I've done a lot of rock climbing. Great. I should be able to like look at the climb and like make sense of it in some way, but I'll pull on and like things will distract me. Things will make me feel insecure. Like if I want to generate, it's just weird to generate. Like I like things like I actually like watching the World Cups more because of that simplicity. Like I think what I'm saying in that like setters are figuring out how to even test climbers, which is a big question that I kind of had in the meet and greet between us that became like, I didn't even know how to ask the question, but like, what do you think about like what should happen? Like if you were a route setter, like what would you set for climbers? Like, you know what, like, because I don't think it's the style that like actually exists that we see frequently, to be completely honest with you. If you ask a lot of competitors, like, yeah, what would you put on the walls to like test each other on? I don't think it would be the style that we see, which is very interesting in thought. I don't, you know, I don't have negative feelings about it necessarily anymore. But yeah, I'm just curious on like your World Cup thoughts. Like, what's the style that is like, I guess, what's the difference that I'm seeing between those two styles?
Yeah. Man, in my experience, I feel like World Cup bouldering rounds have like, I always feel limited in my ability to use the power that I have. And I always kind of attributed that to the root setters trying to separate us, not based on who has the most power or the most finger strength, but who has like the most finesse in their movement and body position. So yeah, in my experience, the more power I try to use in a bouldering round, the more my hands just slip and I lose the feeling of the movement.
That's really interesting. And Tim, that's, I'm glad you asked that question, because we literally had a patron question from Andrew about, what do you think of the current World Cup format? Oh, nice. Are they testing the right things? And can we just pick on that a little bit? Because that makes me sad. Because as I've mentioned in other podcasts, I love vulgar displays of power in climbing. Don't get me wrong. I love all climbing, finesse, slab. But I also love just seeing what top physical athletes' bodies are physically capable. And, you know, if we're talking about bouldering, the psych level being 5, I guess I'd like to see it be, or sorry, you know, psych level to, I'd like to see it be 6. Like, so is that something new that you felt like the World Cups are getting more and more tricky? Would you like to see more power, being tested? Like, how does that make you feel as a competitor?
Yeah. So this will probably make you happy to hear, but I think I've been seeing more and more, big, powerful moves, and like more moves that require people to really get into their shoulders and like, really like, yeah, control a lot of momentum. So I think that the root setters for, you know, 10 plus years strayed away from those powerful movements because they just weren't separating people anymore. And they were developing this new, like this new technique that nobody really knew how to climb on. And they were separating climbers on that. And now it's been long enough that they've been developing that style that they are starting to incorporate powerful movements back into it. And I think that's a really cool, I think that's a really cool thing. And I would love to see them continue to push that blending of power and finesse. The thing that I would like to see more is diversity of holds, because 70-80% of the holds are slopers in World Cups now. And, man, it's kind of a shame, because we got a lot of strong crimpers and we got a lot of weak crimpers, and you just don't know who is who because everybody's climbing on slopers. And there's barely even pinches either, you know? Every time I know that there's barely pinches, because every time I see a pinch boulder, I get excited because I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see Yoshiyuki on this. Like, he's going to he's gonna smash it.
Like, his pinch level compared to the next strongest pinch climber has to be, like, the biggest disparity in strength and a style of movement or hold, right? Like, what's that?
It's got to be some yeah. good lobster claws, too. I love seeing those athletes that can do that.
I love what you're saying about like route setters maybe took one aspect of what we were testing and maybe saw it as too much of an extreme and pulled back one way too far, and then now are balancing. I like that notion. I like that thought. And I think it's true actually in a lot of ways, but unfortunately it just takes a lot of time, right? Because it's like, how many comps even happen? How many route setters, like I mean, America, you know, and then at the World Cup level, I guess, right? Like, I do think like, I would love to see like route setter development happen over time as well. Like, you know, their ability to like get together and like converse as a community in some way so that like people are kind of understanding. Like, this conversation for me is so liberating. It's fun, but it's also just like, it, you know, it's just liberating to like hear you even say things like that. Cause I think competitors hold those opinions to their chest a lot because they're afraid of like, I don't know, that feedback will turn into like some ego battle between like competitors and like what competitors want and like what route setters and what route setters are trying to do. Like, I've always heard route setters be like, I've never heard competitors tell me feedback or something like that. So,
well, it's also
big call out if your competitor, go tell your route setters.
Well, it's also interesting to hear it from someone like you, Nathaniel, who's had a lot of success. Like, you're not saying like, hey, I'm not succeeding and I want it to be different. You know, like, you know, you actually are on the more powerful end of the spectrum, and you've know how to embrace those technical, I mean, it's not like you're crappy on slab by any stretch of the imagination. And so it's just interesting hearing that you're like, hey, perhaps the pendulum has swung too far to one side, and it would be fun to see that. And it kind of brings us to, you know, the next kind of topic is, it's been an interesting World Cup season. Like, we've seen a lot of young talent. I'm going to speak more about the men because it's just the one where it's happened. Actually, I shouldn't say it hasn't happened in the women as much, but we've seen a lot of young competitors do super well in this World Cup season. And I know you're watching, I know you're commenting on it as well. And just what do you think about their success? Any guesses as to why? Or, you know, I guess we're mainly focusing on Serato and Toby, but honestly, there's a lot of strong up and comers.
Yeah. It's been a hell of a World Cup season, man. Some seriously strong up and comers. Serato has shown us what is possible in sloper and friction manipulation. And you know, just to talk about Serato real quick, I think Sean Bailey told me that he has like personally felt and inspected Serato's skin. And he said that it's like some of the best skin he's ever seen. He said it's thick. It's very thick, but it's also like a little bit wet and malleable. It's not like that Daniel Woods, like rock hard callus that would just slip off slopers. So very thick. He's got a lot of skin to fire off or to use up while he's climbing. But it's also malleable enough to get into that like sandpaper texture that we see on so many fiberglass volumes nowadays. But I think beyond that, I think that Serato has like some technique that I'm still trying to figure out that allows him to put like the perfect amount of pressure on a sloper. And also he's so good at controlling the direction of that pressure. And I think those combinations allows him to maximize the amount of friction that he's able to get on those holds. And me and my roommate, Charlie, we've been like theorizing about this, you know, for the last like 4 months. And we have some like Serato trainers in the TC now. It's just like campus sloper boulders. And one of the proudest things I've seen is Charlie has been working on this Serato trainer for like a couple weeks, and he finally did it. And then he went to a comp in Montreal this last weekend, and guess what was there, dude? A campus start sloper, and you just ISO this sloper and come in and match, but you have to have the right body position. And he's the only one that was able to do it. It was like a perfect translation. So I really think there's something to be said about technique with slopers that Serato has and has developed that nobody else really grasps.
I just have this really weird image of Sean like approaching Serato and inspecting his skin. Like, how did that go down? We got to talk to Sean. I want to hear how they're like having a beer. Wait, no, he's 16, man. Yeah, I want to hear the story behind that too. But I also love hearing this, like that sloper campus kind of thing, where that actually sounds more like that blend of power and technique, right? Where it's like you have this body position, but I mean, let's face it, campusing on slopers is burly, right? Like, I mean, that's like that full body engagement that's really fun. Damn, that was interesting. Yeah. What do you think, Tim? What do you think of that?
I wanted to say we have two podcasts that are like, so we go so deep on these thoughts as well. But like, also, it's so crazy, man. Like, you'll say like one sentence and be like, oh, dude, Josh and I have never thought about that. We've never like talked about that. It's crazy. But we had a whole podcast about the World Cup recap, and like, I share a lot of thoughts about like Toby and Serato there. I think like a big thing that I said about Serato in general, or like how I feel about Serato, is he's got like really good. He's got like a really interesting way of using movement theory, which is something that you know, you talk about a lot, Nathaniel, and like you care a lot about. But it's like, it's different to see a 16-year-old just do it, you know, like all the time. He probably doesn't like sit and talk about it all the time. He's just doing it a lot. And like, I really noticed that watching Lead, like in lead when watching him climb, he like climbs more perfectly, like more efficiently than most climbers do. Like, and I think it's because it just like, you're right in that his sloper strength and like the way that he interacts with friction and like creating and generating movements probably didn't come from that much like power or like traditional strength and power that like people use. And it's just a totally interesting way of like creating and climbing. Mm-hmm. And actually, so the person that I think is very, very similar in when I look at Serrato climbing or like watch Serrato climbing and I'm like, dude, there is something different. Cause I agree with you in that. Like, I'm like, dude, I went and grabbed slopers for the next couple of weeks after watching Serrato on things. And I was like, I don't think we have the same, nearly the same opinion about these holds or like how to do it. Like, I think literally our thought process in how to move off the sloper is completely different. Like, watch him. And I went to B Pump and climbed the same ones that he posted. And I was like getting apps. I looked like a beginner climbing on the climbs that he was trying. And I was like, okay, like this is insane. Like, I would love to just sit here and learn for one. But the other person that I thought was really like that in competing against this person and also watching this person a lot was Colin Duffy. Mm-hmm. I think Colin Duffy was also someone who has, you know, I call it gecko like all the time. And I think that's actually a horrible interpretation of what the movement is, because it's like geckos use pretty much solely friction. And what Josh is saying is that it is a mixture of, and what you know, you guys are learning, what Charlie is learning on this campusing thing. And like campusing is so interesting because yeah, it is a technical gecko thing with tons of power. And I was talking about podcasts that we've done, and we did the World Cup recap podcast, and we did a Sloper Love podcast. We have an entire podcast, Nathaniel, talking about why we love slopers.
Yeah.
And going back to what you were saying about, you know, I think, yeah, maybe route setters just like listen to our Sloper Love podcast and we're like, oh, we're going to put a bunch of slopers. Because, you know, our theory on slopers and why they're so fun and interesting and like good for climbing is because it mostly takes away a lot of the variable that you can control in your movement. So there's a lot of technique involved, there's a lot of timing involved, there's a lot of positioning involved.
Yeah.
But you're right in that, just going back to what you said about there is way too much of that in World Cups, first of all. Like, that is one aspect of climbing that should be tested. And we love it. We love climbing on it. But it's like, why are we seeing like 80% of the holds in World Cups? I agree. It's insane. Like, yeah, why is it happening? I want to watch Zhong Wenchun win a World Cup again, dude. Like, he's insane. Like, I want to watch him look like a beast on the stage, right? Like, and that but requires boulders, right? Like, it does require boulders that are super, super, you know, good for him. Anyway, yeah, going back to Serrato and that style, I do think that all those things that you're saying is interesting, but I wanted to bring up Colin Duffy and just kind of think like, or see like what you thought about him, because you've competed with him a lot lately. I think he's also grown into a very different climber than I've watched over the last like 5 or 6 years. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, thinking, yeah, hearing what you guys think about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Colin's got that. He's got that stick. Yeah. And I think I have pretty similar thoughts, I guess, on Colin versus Serrato. I'm sure Colin has like pretty good skin. I've never actually checked it out, but I think that mostly when I watch him move, he just doesn't like pull too hard on the holds. And especially the fiberglass, because I think that when I was learning to climb growing up, we weren't climbing on like hardly any like pure slopers. And so the amount of power you could generate on a hold was just so much more. And if you had the finger strength and you knew how to like get into that good part of the hold, you could put your body wherever you wanted to. And, because you could pull in any direction on that hold, you know? So I think that Colin just learned to climb different. He learned that it's not about pulling in any which direction on this hold. It's about pulling in one direction and using, all right, vocab word coming up. I'm not sure if you guys have talked about this, but using collision fracturing to then control the momentum afterwards.
Wait, what did you say? Right. Say that one more time. Yeah, vocab us, man.
Collision fracturing. The first time I heard about this concept was through Udo Neumann, the German youth coach. When I was competing, he was the German Open national coach. And man, if you're a nerd about climbing movement, you should go follow Udo Neumann and his YouTube channel, because he breaks Udini. It all down. Yeah, Udini. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, Udini. Awesome. Okay, so collision fracturing. It's kind of like a weird term when you think about climbing, because there's not so much collision. There's like collision with your hand in the hold, but the way that I understand it is, you're trying to fracture this large amount of momentum, into smaller pieces of momentum that you can absorb with your whole body. So somebody who does this a lot, and that Udo highlights a lot, is Yanya. When she, let's say that she's, let's say she's dynoing like in a, you know, 20 degree, 30 degree steep cave to like a sloper. It's super important to keep her shoulders directly underneath the sloper and keep pulling directly down. And so she's not gonna, as she's swinging out, you're gonna see her hips and her legs, scorpion up and back. And that's in order to keep her, you know, her center of gravity underneath this hold. Whereas, I think you watch like just a really strong climber that doesn't know how to collision fracture, and they're going to jump to a hold, and they're essentially going to like tighten their whole body, and they're just going to swing on this like, lever, I guess, of their, of their holds. Their holds are going to be their, that's going to be their rotation point. The pivot, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I think Colin is really good at collision fracturing.
Ah, that's, dude, good word for that. And that's so cool. I love that example you used where it's so interesting how what it means to be strong, sometimes people, it's like that, I'm going to stick that hold and be as tight as possible. But that's like, that's not, it's like, well, you want to be tight in the right area, but you want to be absorb that momentum. And you can see how that, I mean, in some ways you can make that same analogy to almost any move where it's like, okay, I want to lock down this side pull, but I need to move smoothly around it so that I'm not yarding on it in a weird way and to get to the next hold. And I don't know, man, I loved all of that, but I also want to, I want to touch on Toby Richards because it's interesting. I might argue, I don't want
Toby Roberts.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Toby Roberts. Sorry, Toby. you know, if you were to watch those World Cups, like it's no big surprise to me that you guys are just geeking and me too geeking out over Serrato. But in some ways, like the media, I would say highlights Toby more, right? Like, and he's different. He definitely has a different style, and it'd be fun to hear you contrast them, Nathaniel, because it's not like Toby's not successful, man. He's doing something really amazing, but damn, are they different? They really climb differently. And so, yeah, love to hear you talk
about that. Yeah. I didn't pay too much attention, and I don't remember exactly how he did in bouldering. Did he make any finals?
Well, he won one.
He won one. Okay.
He won one. Yeah. He went like pretty just like savage mode. I think the way that just provide context, like I think he won one. I think he placed like multiple podiums and like, but some, maybe I don't think he made every final that he did. Serrato was definitely more consistent in a higher ranking, but when Toby would do well, like, that's what made really popular, like, media. Like, he would do a boulder that nobody else did. Like, and he would do it powerfully. Like, he seemed like the most strong and the most powerful in fingers. Like, when I was watching this guy, it was, like, the most ridiculous fingers I'd ever seen for strength. And it's crazy because they're actually opposite styles of climbers. And I would argue that a lot of the style that I watched Toby on just, like, didn't look very natural to him. He just, like, made it work. But, yeah, that's some context that I saw for comps.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't remember his bouldering performance, but the thing that really stuck with me is his lead style, and I definitely agree, Tim. He has the best finger strength that we see on the circuit, and he uses it to its absolute fullest. I feel like we've watched so many really light female lead climbers just climb endlessly on crimps for a couple years. And Toby is the first person who really is emulating that style in the men's, in my eyes. And, you know, it's a controversial style. But man, it's effective as hell. And, I think that
why is it controversial? I want to hear that.
I just mean, it's controversial to be that light, honestly. Like, there's been so much talk about reds in climbing media. And, you know, anybody who is that light is kind of, it seems like they have a spotlight on them right now. So
I don't know if Tim pays as much attention because he is sponsored by Taco Bell and then just loses weight with Taco Bell. He's like, what do you mean? Like, what are you talking about? But yeah, I mean, that is what he looks like. And it's crazy seeing him get to the last hole and turn around and not be pumped and just be like shaking out a crimp being like, what's up, crowd? Look at me. Like, I'm cruising. Isn't this cool? And yeah, it just, that is different, but he's also a young gun. I mean, it's one of the things I love about climbing is seeing different styles succeed, like seeing different looking climbers. And actually, Tim, I thought Toby kind of reminded me a little bit of Zhang Wanchuan, like just that kind of finger power, that lankiness, that just, I don't know. And man, what is it about the UK just turning out kids with strong fingers? It's because they can't go outside, dude. They're just in these cellars and but they're making
By the way, I also thought that Toby, like watching Toby, just because Ross was somebody that I grew up competing with and like trained with a lot and like watched him at his prime. Like when Ross was in his crimping prime, it was very similar to me to watch like watching somebody like go beast mode at lead, like go beast mode on circuits. I was like, oh. And then I watched Toby and I was like, that's just Ross, but like stronger and lighter. Like, I don't know. You're right. Like he does just look lighter, but Ross embraced like a much, you know, a different flow in like training and climbing and whatnot. But yeah, I do think that that style, it's crazy. Like this is where style is so fun to talk about. Like, you know, we're not like dissing or like whatever. It's just like, there's so many different things that work in climbing. Yeah. Right. And it's like, of course we're going to embrace our own and see what works. But like, it's so interesting to like, literally Toby won Brixen. He won Brixen, and just looking at like winners in World Cups and like it's funny because, you know, when you said controversial, I kind of thought you meant like how he uses his power or like how he developed it.
Not
necessarily traditional, but like, I kind of think that as well, where I'm like, I don't know, I wouldn't have trained like that necessarily. And I wouldn't have thought that to be like successful necessarily in climbing, because it's very powerful. It's very strong. Like it's very consistent levels of output. Like when you watch him lead climb, like he knows how to use his technique, of course, but it's like consistent output flow. And like, I think that takes an absurd amount of endurance to do. And it takes an absurd amount of like mental comfort to do, which is like the exact opposite of how I climb. Right.
Dude, I completely agree with like the comfort level that you said with Toby, because I watch him climb and you know who he reminds me of with his try hard? Chris Sharma. Like him and Chris will just both, maybe they're not doing every move perfect, but they're screaming and they're not worried about it. They're just worried about like getting into the next position and doing the next move, no matter what it takes. And they're able to like stay in that like super elevated, like just limit of what's possible for extended periods of time. And then eventually Toby gets a hold that he likes, and then he's able to recover a little bit. And that's something that I think he's better at than a lot of people in the lead circuit.
Dude, so who doesn't want to get compared to Chris? It just makes me, so Toby's seeing success, Serato's seeing success, you've seen a lot of success. And I mean, you guys all look different. You guys all climb different. But I'm going to ask you this question about what do you think makes someone good in, I'm going to say World Cups. And I guess we've been talking about lead, but we can say lead and bouldering. And it's just interesting to hear from someone like you who has seen success, who has a style, and who clearly admires and picks apart other styles. And, you know, what's the thread that maybe you see between them and between yourself and them that has led to being a successful World Cup competitor?
Well, first of all, thank you for putting me in a category with Serato and Toby, but I would kindly disagree.
Dude, no, I disagree with
no.
that.
They don't have Olympic medals. What are you talking about, dude?
Like, yeah.
You look more like Chris than either of those guys. Come on.
The style breakdown and the picking apart of styles, I feel like it's just something that I've used through my whole climbing career to improve my own style. Like When I was younger, I was just like very powerful, very dominant of holds. And that was how I got better. But even back then, I feel like I was watching my friends, and I was lucky to grow up on a climbing team that had like five or six boys my age, and we were all similar strengths. So we were all constantly pushing each other. And there were many moves that I thought they did better than me, and I would immediately go and try the move again and try to emulate what they were doing. So I feel like my strength as a climber is being a copycat.
Dude, we've heard that from a few people, right? Like that was, Will so said that. Important. Who else said, I think that's cool. That I don't think that's a negative is seeing something and then wanting it and learning how it's done and integrating it into your own style. And I think that's really cool.
Mm. I actually think personally that it's a taboo now, like in some ways, like, I don't know how you feel about this, Nathaniel, because, you know, you climb at the TC and stuff, and you've heard me enough times, like outwardly, like dislike some, you know, energy and like some sessions and whatnot. And I feel like personally that's the thing that I run into the most, actually, is that like, I feel like I'm not allowed to like be as like out there for those things. Like, I feel like on a youth team with like, you know, I had a very similar thing where I had like guys very close to my age and like very, very similar strengths. But I was always allowed to openly like be as competitive as possible to like beat them because they were doing that respectfully against me. And like that doesn't exist as much anymore. I've learned over time and I miss that, dude. Like I miss sessions. Like I miss like competing every day against these people because the sole purpose was doing what you're doing, which is copycatting each other. Because when we realized that like if Toby climbed like Serato, he would gain a lot. It wouldn't be harmful. It wouldn't necessarily be like he would just observe. Of course he's himself. Of course Serato's always going to be himself. But if he trained, like I always believe that if Serato and Toby trained together, or like Andre, like I think La Dura Dura was still like one of my favorite climbing movies ever because it was just like the two greatest duking it on the hardest climb ever at that time, right? Mm-hmm. And that was like timeless for so long. That's what I want to see all the time. Like that's why I think climbing is so awesome. It's just like heavy battles of style, and no matter what happens, what I have learned in sessions is that we always grow respect for each other, no matter who's dominant, no matter who. There's always going to be like, I don't know, if you and I session the TC, like you'd probably lead me by like 80-20, you know, like your send rate and like your success rate and your smooth rate would be higher, but like we would walk away respecting each other and we would walk away learning, both of us, right? And like I argue that that is a better way to like learn. And I love hearing that that was significant to you to embrace it. Like, I hope people listen and just embrace that as like, are you making a joke and saying, you know, yeah, my skills being a copycat, but like, no, dude, like your skills observation is being competitive, is being, you know, up in people's face and being like, I'm going to do this. Like, I'll figure it out. Like, I'm going to ask questions. Like, I'm going to do it all. I'm going to find it, you know, and then try it and then embrace it. Yeah. And then that just turned into competing like that. You know, I think that's a fascinating philosophy to live by, and something that is, in my opinion, missing in like current climbing.
Yeah, that's so interesting. At the highest level. How do you make a session competitive while also keeping it good vibes? Because like, if you're with the right people, then it's effortless, right? You can be competitive and it's still good vibes. But if you're not with the right people, then it's it can become bad vibes very quickly.
Dude, yeah, I don't have a good answer. Like,
here's
that.
My old man take is that what it really comes down to is when you're the kind of climber that sees your success as being you getting better and versus others getting worse, like that, you know, that your path is to be the best you can be, and that it doesn't really matter where you end up stacking, where you see some people who climb and they're gonna measure their session as to, was I better than this person next to me? And it's like, well, maybe, maybe not, but were you the best you can be? And so it's just this idea, are you around people that, you know, tear others down to hold themselves up, or do they just hold themselves up as high as they can? And, you know, it's like, I was listening to that pod with you, on the Olympics, Nathaniel, and you said when you came down from the lead, your lead result, or your, you know, the last discipline you did, you came down, you just had this like sense of relief and happiness. 'Cause you're like, oh, I put it out there. Like I performed and you felt good, right? Awesome. But then you didn't even know what you placed. And to me, that's like a really good example where, like, I'm sure when you found out that you placed second, you were more psyched, but that wasn't the point, right? It's like, you're like, no, but I showed up, I did my best. And yeah, I just think that's a good thing to keep in mind that, like, if you really want to achieve great things, you focus on achieving yourself and surrounding yourself with people who, you know, a good friend is someone that's happy for you when you do well and is sad for you when things go bad. But yeah, anyways, that's my old man take.
No, I like that answer.
Yeah, I like that too. I think, you know, probably the biggest, like, respect is important for sure. And I think humility is very important, because I had a time maybe like a year ago where I wonder if Ben Hanna is going to listen to this. Ben, I hope you don't take this the wrong way, but
I'm putting on Instagram.
You know, me and,
that's going right
me
on
and,
Instagram.
me and Ben Hanna have always, you know, been close in skill level. But in training at this time, I felt like I was outperforming him more often than not. And then something changed and we started going back and forth every session. And I was putting out bad vibes because I was like, man, what is wrong with me? Am I getting weaker? Is he just getting better faster than I am? Like, what's going on? But luckily it didn't take me long to realize, this mindset is not helping. So I just need to accept the fact that some days he's going to outperform me and some days I'm going to outperform him. And, as soon as I did that, it was like so much easier for me to train and to stay in a good mood. And then that affected his mood as well. And, so I really think that if you're like, if you consider yourself the stronger of the duo and you start getting smashed, do some soul searching and don't take it personally. Dude, now keep the good vibes.
Let's get Ben on here. He's like, oh, I was putting like oil in Nathaniel's chalk.
It was just cheating tactics.
All right. Well, I got one more question for you in the kind of competition scene in the movement world. And it's actually kind of transitioning out of it. And, you know, comp climbing is unique. I mean, it's comp climbing. It has its own style. And you've had a lot of success in outdoor climbing. And I guess, like, how do you think about movement when it comes to competition climbing? And is it any different from the way you approach outdoor movement? Like, you know, do you see them all under the same umbrella? Do you feel like sometimes you're training specifically for comp climbing or outdoor climbing? Just, you know.
What a good question.
Thank you, Tim.
Yeah.
Jeez, this guy's on fire, man. I could read through Josh's notes and I was like, this is gonna be a banger podcast.
Yeah.
Dude, like,
well, we got
go for
dude,
it,
we
Nathaniel.
Got Nathaniel. Yeah.
We got Nathaniel.
I was looking forward to this question. Yeah, the when you're training indoors and when you're training for competition climbing, I feel like you're developing a lot of skills that will transition to outdoor climbing and outdoor movement. And one of those big skills is collision fracturing. And I think it's something that if you watch somebody who does 90% outdoor climbing, they're usually not as dialed with it, because outdoor climbing, you know, you have these holds that you can actually generate power on. It's very easy to just get sucked into this method of, I just need more finger strength, more body tension, and I can put my body wherever I want, rather than actually, using your full body to collision fracture. But there's such a difference between competition climbers and outdoor climbers. And competition climbers will have success outdoors because they are so good at climbing movement. But if they ever put themselves in like an actual projecting position, trying something that is like very hard for them and will push them to their limit, I think that projecting skill is so, like, it's overlooked. It's a skill that takes years to develop, and it's so hard to project something if you don't have that skill. So anyway, that's I
feel like, yeah, that got lost the projecting like art got lost in like my generation. Like I was a projector at heart because luckily like, well, maybe not, whatever. Like the way that I grew up into climbing was like people like Josh's era, and Josh, you know, came from this like the group of climbers that was in Josh's group, like in the Bay Area, was like absurdly strong and very good rock climbers. And there was a lot of them, and they all climbed a very specific way. They all trained a specific way. Like we would go to PGSF and just watch them and just be like, God, like they're just legends, like all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was always a project mentality. So I embrace project mentality. Like, you know, they're just like sus moves over and over again, make the most minute tweaks. And like, but it was crazy how much belief was always there from like every single try. Like there, you're right, there are so many little attributes about projecting, and like, and I got into those things, but everyone I trained around didn't. And like everyone I trained around except like Brennan, like didn't really care. Like, and you look at Brennan now and he like doesn't compete, he just like goes outside, and that's what he likes, right? He just likes projecting, he likes finding things to like, you know, knock his head on for like hours and hours for days on end, the same one. That doesn't exist very much. And you're right that it's like totally different things. It's funny because we, Josh and I, will talk about like the benefit of comp climbers, and that obviously they can go out and like, you know, cruise boulders really quick. They're really good at that performance mindset. But I never have thought about it in this way that, first of all, just rock climbing alone kind of teaches you poor habits if you're not really paying attention to that collision fracturing. Right. But then also, if you're a comp climber, you won't necessarily even go outside and be able to project. Like, that's such an interesting insight. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And it's like, and the things that I think are difficult about outdoor projecting are just like tactics, you know, and managing weather and all these things that you don't have to do indoors, and patience, you know, and trying and being like nowhere close to a move. And, you know, I go outside and I project, and I've had some success in outdoor climbing, but even still, I wouldn't consider myself just an expert at outdoor climbing. And so I go outside and I try a really hard boulder, and I'm like, this is not possible. Like, what the hell? And then, but if I'm able to stick with it for like a month, then the body is able to adapt. And, I think, yeah.
I find it really interesting where, you know, you had this thing where you're growing up where you were super powerful, and this idea that if you could grab a hold, you could kind of, I know this feeling because this was my style too. You kind of force it. You're like, oh, I'm just going to pull on it like this to throw myself into the next position. And I, you know, comp climbing clearly has evolved and changed that, but, you know, there's this element of just falling in love with what the limit of ability is, right? Like, just how can you try so hard and be so strong on a move? And I think that there is something about outdoor climbing that embraces that kind of like, what is humanly possible, where comp climbing has constraints on it. I mean, it's like, not only is it just today, it's 4 minutes or five, you know, whatever the case may be, it's like now. And it just makes me, you know, rather than say like comp climbing should be different, just it makes me think about how someone like you, as you head more into outdoor climbing, or if you choose to head more into outdoor climbing, you know, bringing all of those facets together. It's why what I would see, what I harp on a lot in this podcast, is people from my generation look at comp climbing and denigrate it and think that those skills aren't useful. And I always laugh at them because I'm like, okay, how come that you know, 15-year-old who was doing that parkour now went out and flashed your crimpy project, you know, because like, you know, you they're still doing it. Like, you know, Tomoa still went and flashed like that crimpy V14.
Just undecided.
Yeah. Good job, Tomoa. Jesus. So I don't know. Just love seeing that both sides of the story there. And I don't know if, is anything else you want to tackle on that movement between outdoors or indoors? Are we ready to do a complete right turn or left turn or 180 into Twitch streaming? I'll let you say your piece.
I have a question for Nathaniel on that same note. Sure. We're just talking about, I guess, like, do you have a thought on you know, a concoction or a balance that is best for climbers. Like, you know, if you could do it all over again, or like have the future facilities, like, you know, what's balanced? Like, you know, you go around the whole world, Nathaniel, you've been around the whole world. You've been to many, 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 many climbing gyms. Like they're all purposeful, right? They're all purposeful, like the type of training that you want to do. And it's also purposeful, like how climber styles change throughout the movements that they're doing, right? It's what we're talking about. And yeah, do you have an opinion on what's best? Like, what would you do if you start all over again? Or like, you know, what gym would you open and create? What would it look like? I'm always curious.
Yeah. That's a really good question. And it's maybe the first time I've ever really thought about it.
What?
I super admire B Pump and what they've done. I super admire the climbers who come out of B Pump and the way that they move and the way that they learn to move. But you know, I'm trying to think, are they missing anything in their climbing repertoire? And I mean, they're certainly not as good at crimping as the British are, because the British grow up climbing on, everybody has their own home wall. Everybody has their like crimp projects that they try, you know, for 2 years on their home wall, and that develops a crazy crimp strength. So I think for me personally, I would have loved to have grown up in a B Pump like facility, because that kind of movement just appeals to me so much. It just looks so fun, so flowy, and that's the kind of movement I nerd out on.
Tim, is that just, I literally was going to say, like, Tim's just waiting for you to say B Pump. Nathaniel, we did a whole entire podcast after Tim came back from Tokyo where he climbed a B Pump. I think it was called, Is This the Best Climbing Gym in the World? And it was just a homage to B Pump. I mean, not complete, but that's interesting to hear you say that. Tim, I'm sure you're chomping at the bit to add something there.
No, I think the answer is so fascinating to me, dude. Like, I didn't think that you would actually say something like, just like, yeah, if I could just climb a B Pump, like, but you're totally right, man. Like, you know, it's actually a culture thing. Like, that's why I think that answer is a little bit amorphous when you're thinking about it. I've, you know, probably theorized what I think, you know, from 5 years old, like what would the best climber need to do in terms of like saturation of hold types, movements. Like, you know, I've literally thought about this since I started climbing. Like, damn, like I start at 13, but if I were to start at 5, what would I do? And because I didn't, what do I need to do to catch up to that? And, you know, all these types of thoughts. And, yeah, I've thought about that a lot. And for some reason, like, yeah, when I went to B Pump, I, you know, it was what, like my 11th year of climbing. And I told Josh, I was like, dude, why didn't I just like have this gym to climb at this entire 11 years? Because, you know, if I just had a hangboard or, you know, like a hard woody and B Pump, then yeah, you're right. Literally what you said. I was like, yeah, I guess I could just have a moonboard and B Pump and I would probably be the best climber. Like, you know, it is a balance though.
The thing you literally just said is like, you just wanted to mix Serato and Toby into one person, right? Like the best climber ever.
I think it's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, I think it's so fascinating to understand and really believe and embrace that B Pump. You know, when I went to B Pump, I think the biggest thing that I said was, it's just a climbing gym. Like, I walked in, like, waiting for, since it opened, to like go and check it out. And I finally get to come. I'm like, you know, all new. I've been to climbing gyms. I've seen like, you know, Innsbruck and all these things and the TC. And I walked in, I was like, dude, this area of bouldering is like 7,000 square feet.
Guys,
yeah. It's tiny.
You guys, I grew up climbing at the Rocknasium. It was like one of the earlier gyms. It was like 20 feet tall. I would go to gyms where they'd have pea gravel as their ground, like pea gravel. Like you would land on pea gravel. And Tim, you grew up at Plant Grant Sunnyvale, which I will never forget the first time I walked in there. I was going to school in Santa Cruz and I drove over the hill. I walk in and there was a freaking gri-gri on every rope. Which gri-gris are like expensive. And I was like, oh, things done changed. Like this is for real. And Nathaniel, I'm sure you grew up at the front, climbing on great stuff out there. I'm just giving you guys shit. It is interesting hearing, it is interesting hearing that thing. Like it's just a climbing gym. But you guys didn't have it too bad, but I really do believe that it matters where you grow up training. And we always talk about how, like, Tim, I'm sure when you started climbing, there was V12 set, V13's in the gym. And so you go, oh, I mean, yeah, it's in the gym. Like, I'm going to climb V13 or whatever. And I remember, I would say that probably the hardest boulder in the gym, they even have grades, are probably like V6s, you know, and you just, it makes you have this ceiling that's like, oh, well, V6 is hard. So V7 must be really hard. Where if you grow up in the gym and there's, and the black tape is like V16, you go like, well, that's hard, but I mean, it's right here. So I can do it someday, you know? And so anyways,
That exact thing that you're talking about, I think is what climbers and setters and like really good climbers have embraced over time, is that like the type of ceiling that we want in climbing, or like to explore daily, to practice daily, isn't the number grade as much. It's style, it's movements. It's like, I go to B pump and like fall in a V4. I'm like, okay, let's like try this again and let's perfect it, because I'm strong and smart enough to know how to perfect this, but I want to fall. Like, I want to find all the styles in between like V4 and like V8 there more than anywhere, just to fall on, because the way that they set it forces you to find like a new how, like a new like belief in what climbing actually is, like all these things that we're talking about, theory and whatnot. Like, people have opinions, people have like grown opinions. Well, it seems like the best place to like challenge your opinions, find new opinions, right? And like, that's, I think that's, for me, like, I've always theorized, like, what does a perfect climber look like? Like, if I started with a kid at 5 years old, like, what facility would I put him through? What drills would I put him to? Like, what was it going to look like? And you're, Nathaniel's right, dude. It's like, it's a lot of B pump, a lot of B pump style, a lot of B pump sessions, a lot of B pump people. Like, it's a lot of that, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. All right. Well,
all right, we can move
on. let's, dude, I mean, that's just a topic we could do a whole podcast on. Oh, wait. We did. You know, it seems like, Nathan, you have a lot of opinions on the World Cup scene. It seems like you've been watching them. Not only have you been watching them, you've been using Twitch to stream your commentary live while watching the World Cups. And that's kind of unique, man. Like, what prompted you to do that? And tell us more about Twitch and how you can use it to, I don't know, bring climbing into that whole streaming world.
Yeah. I kind of got inspired by chess streamers and League of Legends streamers. Those are two things that I, you know, those are my hobbies outside of climbing. And there's so many really entertaining people who will just do exactly what I'm doing. They put their little face in the bottom corner and they commentate over the live stream of this like world championships in League of Legends. And I found it so entertaining. And I know that nobody has been doing it in climbing. So I was like, I think this could go over well. And, you know, I feel comfortable talking live and talking to, you know, a group of viewers. So I might as well try it. And, you know, the first couple streams were a little stuttery here and there. There's another thing about Twitch is there's like a live chat. So all of your viewers have the option to like write comments. And a big part of Twitch is like interaction between the streamer and the chat. And, you know, I was just getting distracted. Every message that was coming up, I was reading and responding to. And we ended up not even like focusing on the World Cup that was right in front of us. But since then, I've gotten a little bit more dialed, and it's been a lot of fun, and I've been really surprised at just how quickly you become comfortable with these like anonymous names in your chat. You know, I have like 10 or 12 names, and every time I see them, I'm like, oh, welcome to the stream. Good to see you again. Welcome back. So yeah, it's been really fun. I was kind of doing it on the low key, because IFSC, they charge European viewers to watch the World Cups, and Twitch is a free service. So if IFSC found out that I was doing these live streams, I imagine they would ask me to stop, because anybody in Europe can just watch my live stream, essentially watching the World Cup for free. So just recently I got found out by the IFSC, you know, it was bound to happen. And we had to change the format a little bit. So now, instead of having my face in the bottom corner and climbing on the big screen, I have to put my face on the big screen and climbing in the little corner. So definitely not ideal. But apparently if we do that format, it's protected under free use is what I'm told. I don't know anything more than that. So we're still doing it. It's a little bit less ideal if you're from Europe, but if you're from the US, people have been telling me that they've pulled up my Twitch stream on one computer just to listen to my commentary and then the actual stream on the big computer. So they have the climbing right there in front of them. But yeah, it's been fun. and people tell me they enjoy it.
I love that you are taking your knowledge, your, I guess, celebrity, and then your love and like putting it together in a unique way. And I don't watch chess or League of Legends. I used to watch StarCraft a lot, which is just some random game that's kind of like, I don't know, it's kind of like chess, but yeah.
Computer, respect, yeah. Just, yeah, that's a serious game.
Dude, it's so fun for me to watch that stuff. That's something I've definitely never shared on the pod. I love it. And they're really entertaining and, you know, you get in deep. And what helps is having someone who's commenting who really knows the game, right? Like really knows what they're talking about. Actually, I will say I do love some of the commentators. Like I think Megan Martin has been a really good commentator. But me and Tim have even talked about doing the same thing before we even knew that you were doing it. And so just seeing someone like you take up that and push it forward is super cool. And we'll link to it, you know, in the show notes.
I think something that's really interesting about, like, I've watched a lot of streams as well, different things, and you know, a lot of climbing streams, of course. But, you know, commentators, like live comment, there'll be a lot of streams for things where there's live commentators and then there's like streaming commentators. And streaming commentators tend to be the ones who are like more experts and like more people who can like debrief the content and like the context, the nuance behind the scenes. And, you know, I imagine like, I really want to watch actually some commentating things of just Nathaniel just going at it, because it's just so interesting to hear. Like, I mean, this whole podcast has been interesting, of course, but it's like,
Tim, we're literally doing that right
now. Right. Yeah, of course. But like going, you know, feedback on live climbing, I think is like totally different. And you mentioned also that you guys were doing like pusher sessions with the boys. You guys would like session. And actually, like the first time I saw you like drop a little link, it was super low key. It was just like Nasty Nate, just like on a little like Twitch Nasty Nate, just like a fortune cookie, just like a paper.
Yeah, yeah.
Like no context or anything, just Twitch. And I was like, all right, cool. Nathaniel's streaming. And I assumed immediately that it was a climbing session. I assumed immediately that, and that's what Josh and I kind of thought about first, was like, we should play like Horse on the Moonboard together, like over live chat or whatever, and people should watch, because not only can we play a game that's entertaining, but we can like explain what's going on, like the things that we think about, and like what an easy way of sharing information, of sharing the perspectives, of like sharing opinions in climbing, that right now I think climbing media is like oversaturated with, you know, like there's got to be a nicer way of saying this, but like pretend experts, right? Like because they're not experts in climbing, but they're told to be experts because Instagram like highlights them or YouTube highlights them like absurdly. And I think that there's great things in media for that reason, but it's overly saturated. The ratio of actual experts who like share information or like share their thought processes is really, really low, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's why I find it fascinating and awesome that you're going to do that over time.
Yeah, tell us more about
that. Do you have like, what's the future of Twitch for you? Like what for you have you learned? Like what's intriguing? What's going to be like the main thing that you are going to stream over time, do you think?
Yeah. So the pusher sessions, they are definitely younger and less popular as of now than the World Cup live streams, which is fine. I still have fun with them, but and I'm still learning how to make them more enjoyable for the viewers. But I think we're making good progress. So pretty much what it's been is me and, you know, two to four friends all show up to Pusher, and Pusher has this spray wall that's just like really hard. Like it's probably even harder than the TC spray wall.
Wow.
And we at first I was like, people are just going to enjoy watching us session. Like watching good movement, watching the crazy falls, like watching the interactions between friends. And that's kind of true. But pretty quickly, people started being like, hey, can I make you up a boulder? And I was like, I mean, you can try, but like, it's going to be hard with the screen. And they're like, oh no, I'll just like screenshot the thing and like circle these holds and I'll send it to you on Discord. And I was like, oh, that's genius. And so now we've got it set up where, so Discord is a platform that kind of goes hand in hand in Twitch. It's a place for like, you can like build your own community, I guess. I kind of describe it as like a Facebook page, but I have a Discord as well that goes along with my Twitch. And so on this Discord, you can find, the Retro Flash app, which I uploaded the, pusher wall to. It's like, what's that spray wall app? Yeah. It's like Stoked, but it's free.
Stoked, yeah.
So, I uploaded it to the Discord and people can find my board, the pusher board on it, and they can make their own boulders and I can just find it in the app. And, you know, a lot of
how fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And they don't have a good idea of what all the holds are. So a lot of the boulders are like really just not a go, but sometimes they get one. And I've spent like 30 minutes to an hour working on this boulder that some random viewer made up for me the other day. And it was sick for them to watch me, like, to feel like they contributed to my session. And it was fun for me because I found new movement.
So that's so freaking cool. And first, I want to shout out to Jared Roth again. This is like the second pod in a row that we shout out to him. And just, he's been on the podcast too, by the way, Nathaniel. And he had just a bunch of nice things to say about you. I also want you to shout out some of the boys that you're sessioning with, just because like that'll just help. I don't know, anyone who's a fan of them, you know, can log in. So who are you sessioning with often?
Yeah. So Chris Kosser, Ben Hanna, and Zach Gala are like the main pusher boys. They all have keys to the place, which is like the highest honor that Jared can bestow upon you. Ross joined us for a session. My roommate, Charlie Barron. And I don't know, I should probably be saying these boys' last names as well.
That is a freaking strong crew, by the way, for everyone listening.
Yeah.
Those sessions are for real. And I guess just my ask of you, because it's like what I've been doing on this pod the whole time that I'm so lucky to get to chat with you, is like, I would love it if when you know, people make up a boulder or something for you, or you guys make up a boulder, you explain to people like me on the live stream, like, you know, what's your, like, how are you thinking about, how's this boulder going to go? Like, you think, I'm probably going to bike here, you know? And then when it doesn't work, you go like, I sagged too far out the wall, so I couldn't generate. So I'm going to try this time. And just anything to pick a brain like yours and all those other, that strong crew, I would love, I just love what you're doing with that, man.
Yeah, I appreciate it. That's something that I'm working on currently, is like voicing more of my thoughts as I fall, as I project the boulder, because I know that people will enjoy hearing that. And I think that, that could be something that keeps people coming back. So.
I don't know if you saw me, but I subscribed. I put my,
oh, for real?
Oh yeah, dude, of course. That is exactly why we were so psyched to get to talk to you here, and to get to do that on the reg would just be incredible. And the whole thing just made me think of Dave Graham's comment a while ago. I don't know, you guys are probably too young for this, but Dave Graham said something along the lines of, in the future, what's going to happen is we're going to have videographers streaming every pro climber session. You know, you're going to want to see Dave, you know, working the Big Island back in the day. You're going to want to see like what the training looks like. And I think what goes hand in hand with that is kind of hearing, you know, getting to know that person. So it's a little more intimate. So instead of just me, you know, I watch some video of you doing Grand Illusion, and like, there is some of you on there, right? Like, I get to like hear your thought process, but like, I would have loved to see is you're like, dude, I'm psyched on this boulder, but like, I'm kind of like a little too excited. I'm going to try this thing, calm down. Then watching you send and being there for that whole process, like that could be, that is a future of bouldering, and seeing you be creative in this way is so cool, man. So cool.
I appreciate it. Yeah. That's something that I'm excited for and nervous for, when people start bringing the live stream to the boulder. 'Cause it's like, That's going to change a lot of vibes at the Boulder, especially if other people come and they don't know that it's live streaming. You know, it's going to be an interesting thing for the culture to tackle.
Hey guys, let's keep it PG-13.
I think it's most appropriate. wait. I thought it was fascinating, like, just the idea of like spray walls, you know, boards, standardized climbing. Like, personally, I think I view like simpler tools for climbing as like really special tools for climbing, because that's where like really high level climbing nuance comes out the best. I have learned over the last like year and a half or 2 years of climbing with Michaela, my girlfriend. She's just like brand new, stoked as hell, like all the time, just like savage mode climbing all the time. And I think it's interesting for her to like date someone who's been climbing for a long time and like tries to get better at climbing literally every day. Mm-hmm. And she asks me a lot, you know, sometimes explaining things are very frustrating for climbing. You know, like, it's one thing to coach it, and like, I've coached climbing. I wonder if you're going to feel this, because this is very similar to like what, you know, that's why you're like saying you're working on it, because it's really, really hard. And I'm just like sharing with you like how hard it actually is. But coaching is really easy, because in some ways, because you're giving information on what you're seeing. And when you're observing and giving information on what you're seeing, it's a lot easier to, like, I don't know, not be so, like, the things that you see are just easier to talk about, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. When you're breaking apart truly, like, what you're feeling and things, like, you're usually just doing the reactions yourself. You're doing the adaptations yourself. Like, there's no need to talk about it. And that's, for me, like, this podcast has been so special, because I haven't heard you like go like share those types of opinions that often. And I think it will always be fascinating the more and more you do it. And that's like the beauty of those streams, right? Like, that's the beauty of like deconstructing your climbing, for like, you have to know what the audience already knows and like what they don't know. And you have to be able to explain it, because yeah, what Josh is talking about, like, why did you turn your knee that way? Why did you move your foot here instead this try than the other try? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you breathing this way now? Like, there are so many things that we've gone into deep that obviously reasons occur. Like, obviously reactions and adaptations occur for reasons, and those exist. And like, it'd just be fun to like hear you explain it during the session. And like, yeah, I'm going to subscribe to it. I can't wait to watch it here. And I'm going to make some of my own too. I'm stoked, dude. Like,
sick.
It's super fun to do.
Yeah. I'm psyched for more people to get into the scene, because, you know, we can start building a multi-channel community and, like, you know, rating each other.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's going to be good for the climbing community.
Well, it's nice. Interesting that you said that could, you know, change the vibes having streaming. It made me think of this quote I snagged from you when we were doing our meet and greet. Was, we were talking about how you adapt to things changing, whether it was different rules and competitions, or even maybe, you know, different styles. And, you know, Tim was like, you know, what do you change? He said, I don't really change anything. I just get into the right mindset and perform as best I can. And I just think that's kind of a really good takeaway from all of our talk about mental game, is there's all these things you can't control. There's all these, you know, like, maybe you get a weird message on Twitch that might, like, you know, break you out of your moment or whatever, but it's kind of just like, I don't know, it's different, but I'm here to do my best. And I just want to, you know, transfer that into kind of what's next for you, Nathaniel. You know, we've been talking a bunch about competing. You know, I know that competing maybe isn't something that you've been doing as much lately, but clearly the psych is high for everything climbing, Twitch, talking about World Cups, training at Pusher, and just, yeah, what are you psyched on right now? Yeah, how's it going, man?
What is next? That is a big question I've been asking myself a lot. You know, it was a big decision, and one that I never really publicly announced, which I regret, and maybe I should still do that, but I decided not to go for the Olympics for Paris. I decided that at the beginning of this year, like March, April. So I didn't do any of the World Cups this year, and that pretty much puts me out of the running for the Olympics. So my reasoning behind that was I kind of had this like freak accident where I was projecting a sport route. I was in Pop Tire Cave, which is like 3 hours west of Salt Lake City. And I had fallen in this roof and I was like, you know, pissed. So I was going to do the biggest boink I could, you know, just to show them what's up. And I did a massive boink and the rope just wrapped one time around my pointer, middle and ring finger on my right hand. And when my body weight came back down, that just one loop, it like crunched my fingers and took a bunch of skin off. It was like bloody and like swollen. I lowered straight to the ground and just straight passed out. Ben Hanna was belaying me. He was like, dude, that was the craziest thing I've ever seen. I thought you were going to die. And so, yeah, anyway, it was a crazy thing, but it was like 7 or 8 weeks before nationals, before nationals, which was the first in a long series of steps towards qualifying for the Olympics. And it pretty much just set me on this like mental path of like, oh man, my finger got like, it got so messed up, like right before nationals. I just really don't think I'm meant to try for Paris again. Like this could be a sign, you know, not that I'm religious or even spiritual, but sometimes I do kind of read into things happening. So anyway, nationals goes like way better than I expected, but still I'm like, man, I'm going to have to ball out at team trials in order to qualify for the team and try to compete. But you know, classic Nathaniel way, I do just well enough and ball out and all of a sudden I'm on the World Cup team. And then I got to make the decision again. Okay. Do I want to compete or do I want to do other things? And I start thinking about the other things I could do. And I was like, oh man, I could spend the whole year just climbing outside, you know, and no pressure, no nothing, just like travel and really just live that like pro climber life that I've seen Chris Sharma and Jimmy Webb and Daniel Woods doing for like my whole climbing career. And that really appealed to me. And so I eventually decided I was not going to compete and I was going to try to expand my world of climbing.
First of all, bummer about that accident. I'm glad it wasn't as bad as it could have been. You know, that's rough.
Yeah.
I mean, dude, like injuries are for real and scary and really can shake you up. Although it cracks me up that you just did so well right away. You know, just kind of goes to show you that, well, it shows you the foundation and the work you put in. But what you really said to me and what I could hear in all those moments each time where you had successes, like just your psyche wasn't there. And, you know, everything we've talked about in this whole podcast, you can see, you can see your psyche come out about things, and mental game is such a strong component of what it means to be a competitor and a, you know, a climber in general. And, you know, you have to have that with you to perform at a high level. And if you don't, I mean, I don't know if that's a hint from the universe as much as just really trusting in yourself and your instincts and knowing what's good or not. So yeah, you said your psyche wasn't there and you took that as a hint.
No, yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, even before the accident, I was out in Arizona working on this longtime project with my friends, and I was just kind of like just throwing it out there. I was like, guys, you know, what if we didn't compete this year? What if we didn't try to go for the Olympics? What if we just all climbed outside? And they were kind of like, oh yeah, that'd be sick, you know. But I don't know, it was just like me putting it out there. But yeah, that was my first clue that the psych just wasn't there. And that's a great segue into something that has kind of defined my climbing and my path through climbing. And it's this term, the power of the psyche, which was introduced to me by my coach and mentor, Kyle O'Mara. He always told me, like, dude, you perform so well in competition because you are just like, you're so psyched to be there. And that the power of the psyche is like so much more, so much more of an advantage than being stronger or being more technically skilled. Like just being excited to be there and happy to be there is the most important thing. And then I just didn't have it. Just didn't have the power of the psych. So I spent, I thought that the psych was on outdoor climbing. And, but you know, I'm sad to say that 6 months later, I have not gone on hardly any outdoor climbing trips. And, pretty much this whole year has just been, me training for training's sake, indoors, practicing comp movements, not competing, and trying to figure out what the heck I'm gonna do next. Because, you know, outdoor climbing is hard. It's putting together a trip. And I'm gonna sound dumb here, but putting together a trip is not easy. And for me, it's easier than everybody else because I'm a pro climber. So I have support. And anyway, I just pretty much have no excuse. I don't know why I didn't go outside this year, but.
I would just double down on what Kyle said, because I reached out to Kyle beforehand. He was like, ask Nathaniel about the power of the psych. And, you know, I think that's something, again, this is my old man talk, is like, you know, you think 6 months is a long time. But it's kind of not, you know, it's kind of like, it's nice to say like, oh, follow your heart or whatever, but like things don't quite work out like, oh, this chapter is over. So this is how this next chapter goes. And, the other thing that cracks me up is this idea of putting together outdoor trips. I've been lucky enough to go on outdoor trips with, lots of pro climbers, and I always felt so blessed, like, oh my gosh, like they want me to go, like I'm not that great, like, and I just would find out, yeah, they just need people to go with them, man, like like there's not that many people who can like just pick up and go, and you know, finding that crew, I mean, dude, that's what we were talking about even earlier, but
yeah,
finding that psych crew, finding the people that support you, and so, you know, I think what you're saying is just this awesome thing, like where you're following your psych. And I also love the other thing that you're doing that's a really good job is, okay, like when people get hurt, and when I say people, I mean me, it's like, okay, this sucks. I'm going to go eat a bunch of ice cream and do nothing. And what I hear from you is you're like, I'm training. I'm in good shape. I'm, you know, I'm here. Like you're still showing up. And so I think that's a big takeaway for every athlete and professional out there is like, you know, maybe you don't know, maybe your next chapter is still waiting to show itself, but don't find it by sitting on the couch, right? Like that's different.
I want to say something that stuff is so good and it's so important to like keep that North Star going forward. But I want to say something because in some way, like, I mean, we're in a vulnerable state now and that's awesome that we can talk about this type of stuff. But, you know, I want to say something because I like very much ran into similar like thought processes and like a similar like up and down. Like I didn't, you know, deglove my finger and like break it and then have this like, you know, insane up and down process going into the comps. And I remember like talking to you about this stuff at Nationals too. I was like, how's your finger and stuff? Like that's insane to compete and like that's super rough and like good luck, you know. And then you did amazing and it was like, holy shit, you know, that's like that's Nathaniel. But then I had a similar like going in and out of like psych for competitions. And I guess like one thing that I heard a lot from how you did really well in competitions was, again, this like clarity digestion process. And I guess like one thing that may not necessarily be the same thing for you, but something that has helped me a ton, and maybe just like helps people like changing goals and like changing lifestyles, like, you know, figuring out new things is like, I think it's okay to remind yourself that like, for me, I was going through a lot of grief, actually. I was going through a lot of grief of like not doing the same like motions again, like not doing the same comps, like not doing those things. And I didn't realize how much fulfillment I got from those things alone. And that's a huge part of digestion for me. Like it took me a really long time, like many months, to just be able to like realize that I was actually just sad from not competing. And then that kind of like, I was doing the same thing where I was like, I moved to Vegas and like had a bunch of outdoor goals. And then I never went outside. I never really like, people were hitting me up and were like, let's go to Charleston. Let's go to like wherever. And I'm like, yeah, and I would just like never follow back. But I didn't mind. It didn't matter to me. Like, to be honest, it just like didn't matter even that I was saying no. I would still go to Refuge and like climb at the gym and have banger sessions. Like I would text Josh, like I was moonboarding, like it was super fun, like whatever. And then I would like turn that into developing these new things that I was doing. And I guess like, yeah, maybe it's just a reminder to like let yourself be sad also, like be sensitive and have some grace for like what you're missing. You know, it's like, it's okay. Like, I think that's how I felt about it. And, you know, again, it's not just, I'm not saying straight up to Nathaniel, but like, you know, for all of us, like we always change things that are happening, like, and we might just be attached to like the thing that was happening before. And it also doesn't mean that for me, actually, like, I don't know how you feel about this, Nathaniel, but watching the World Cups, I didn't compete at all after nationals. I didn't even do team trials, and I'm not doing nationals this year either. Like, I clicked that decline button. I don't know if you got the email, and I clicked decline, and it felt so crazy. It felt so good, but also like so crazy. I was like, yo, what? Like, I haven't clicked that button ever, and like, I've never even thought about that. Yeah. But actually, this whole season I was watching World Cups, I actually was antsy as hell. But again, it was just like I was real with myself enough that I actually knew that I didn't want to be there this season. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm sure you still feel like we're still here, yeah, like going deep about the World Cups, like obsessing about climbing and stuff. But it's like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe it's just like not necessarily like the time this year to feel the need to like go and do it, you know. But I wonder, do you feel like you're going to go back to it? Maybe that's a too early question, but curious.
I got to say, man, I really appreciate what you just said about like, grieving the loss of a lifestyle, because having competed for like my whole time climbing since I was 10, so 15, 16 years of competition, that is the grind. That's what you develop your whole routine, your whole lifestyle. That's everything. And so transitioning out of that, it's definitely not going to be easy, and I should be more understanding towards myself. So thanks.
More grace.
Yeah.
Right? It's just hard. It's just hard.
Totally. Like,
and that's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going back to it, I haven't decided on nationals this year. I've decided on bouldering. I'm not doing bouldering. And that's because I said to myself, if they do bouldering nationals in a gym again, I'm not going to compete. Mm. Because, dude, man, it's just not what it was. It's just not nationals, man. It's they need it in an arena on a built wall with stadium seating. And if they can't do that, you know, maybe it's a money thing, maybe it's something else, but it's not.
But it doesn't matter.
It's not my vibe. I'm not doing it. So
yeah, why not honor the most, like, Nathaniel was by far the most serious psyched competitor. I mean, Daniel Woods had his stint of never losing.
Yeah.
Nathaniel was just winning every time. And it's like, why don't we take that seriously? It's like, all right, Nathaniel says he's winning because there's this arena stage. The convention center was dope. The podiums were dope. The stage was dope. And like, yeah, we got to bring those back, man. Like, those were the absolute coolest vibes.
I would love it.
Serious comps.
I love it.
I love even just spectating. I mean, I've competed on that wall in the arena before, but even just spectating, it makes you feel like this is something special, you know, like it makes it a competition. So I do hope they bring that back. And, you know, I don't know, hearing you talk about all this stuff with competition, it really brings to mind this comment you made in a podcast where you're talking about the Olympics and you won the bouldering round. And you made some comment about how you're like, oh, like I beat all of these great other athletes. And you made a comment where you like I proved to myself that I could win on that stage with some of the best boulderers the world has ever seen. And it's just interesting to, you know, to see someone wrestle with the next chapter from that standpoint where, you know, you showed up, you worked hard, you performed and it went well, and you literally used those words that you proved to yourself. And you know, it's just, it's exciting for me to, you know, to see what that next chapter becomes. And whether that is you going back to climbing or competitions at some point, I mean, I think that's the sport that we all love, is that there's so many different ways to excel and explore. And sometimes it's almost intimidating to like choose that discipline. And it's like, are you a boulderer? Are you a sport climber? And I always say this to my buddies. I'm just like, nah, dude, I just love climbing. Like, you want to take me on some amazing trad route that I know is like 5 stars and classic? Like, I'm going to raise my hand and say yes, you know? And it's just, you know, opening yourself to all those experiences and then listening to that psych and then chasing it, I think is, you know, something that I heard from you, you know, and I'm just looking forward to what that next chapter is, man.
Yeah, much appreciated. I'll tell you about the few of like the objectives I have on my radar right now. This November, I'm trying to get a crew to go and revive Defy Gravity. One of the most inspiring boulders of my childhood. And it, you know,
you text me.
It needs a third ascent. Yeah. I'll shoot you a text.
Wow. Oh my God.
That's coming up. You know, I have no expectations. I know it's very hard, but it'll be cool to at least just get started on it. And,
Dude, hold on. Just, I want to hear your next objective.
Yeah.
This is like, to me, like, this is actually one of the reasons why I like putting out content and stuff in the climbing world is I know that video. I watched that video a million times. I can hear the wind going in the camera while Daniel's like pulling those top moves and it's just freaking gusting. And like, that is what those kind of things like cause me to buy tickets around the world, right? It's like, oh, I want to go do Shoshaloza in Rocklands because of that clip, you know, like, and so I just think that's so cool to, I mean, dude, when you say that, it just instantly raises the hairs on the back of my neck. It's like I get
me
it.
Me too. Yeah. Oh my God. Sick. My arms just, I was like, yes.
Okay. Defying gravity.
Sick.
Yeah. What else? Yeah. Please. All right.
The next one
too,
is not as legendary. Yeah. Let's see. So the next one is just the Arizona Proj, the thing I've been working on for many, many years. Me and Sean Bailey, we're trying to get Sean Rabatou / some other really high-end boulder to come out. And we'll be down there late December to early January / maybe all of January. And yeah, heading back to the Life Project. So
I
at least I got some things on my calendar. It's a route.
Yeah. I don't know a lot about this one. Wait, was there a video series on this? And is there any media out there already about it?
Yeah. So, I did the first ascent of Lee Majors, which, ended up being 14C. And there's a 3-part series on Petzl's YouTube channel called the Dry Canyon series that just documents doing that first ascent. And then I also bolt the top. So that route ends like right at the edge of this super steep cave. And then there's like another 60 feet of gently overhanging headwall. So I bolted the rest of that in that series. And then ever since then I took a couple years break. But for the last couple years, I've been back working on the extension.
Oh, sick. Yeah,
$6 million man project.
Where'd they get that name from?
So it's in an air. The crag is called the Celebrity Cave, and the original name of the project was the $6 million man project. And then Lee Majors.
So cool.
And that's like an old, for those who don't know, that's like an old, old movie / TV series about this guy who gets injured and then he gets all these like robotic replacements and he's the $6 million man. And he's played by Lee Majors.
That's good. I saw that series for the lower anchors. That's so sick that there's just a mega extension. Those are good goals, man. Those, I can see the psych, like just you talking about
awesome.
Them. So, I can't wait to follow along, man. Those are great. Okay. Let's wrap up with a couple of rapid fire ones. Nathaniel, do you have a pro tip for us by any chance?
Got my pro tip.
Let's hear it.
My pro tip is when you go climbing indoors, focus as much as you can on the friction that you're getting with your skin. I think a lot of people, they get climbing and they maybe don't realize it, but their skin is oily. And they just start off their session like slipping and sliding on holds. And it can send them down this whole progressive path of like having a bad session. So first pro tip, wash your hands with soap and water before you chalk up. Your hands are going to be clean. You're going to have better friction. You chalk up. You start warming up. Once you get to a level that's like fairly challenging for you? Like maybe you're ending your warm up, you're beginning to start your like your a little bit harder moves. Brush the holds and just see what difference it makes. And just focus your whole session on like the friction of your hands. And if you start to slip and you know you're about to rip off this hold and lose a bunch of skin, just let go. So that's my pro tip.
That's some total pro shit right there. That is not what people think about when they're climbing. They're like, oh, I just ate this burrito. My hands are all greasy. That's definitely been some of our pro tips around like clean your hands and brush the hold. Nothing is worse than being that guy outdoors. Some random person walks up and they like have sunscreen on their hands and they grab your crux hold with their greasy mitts and they're not even trying your proj. And oh man, I got all angry at there for a second. I've got, sorry. Woo. Little rant over. I got another, patron question. Michael asked about how he's heard you talk about how you love practicing fundamentals, like especially fundamentals for timing moves. And he was just wondering, like what, when you think of timing moves, like what are your fundamentals? What are your fundamentals or first principles and how do you actually practice that?
Yeah. The timing move that I'm thinking of is like a dead point. So, you're on a move. It's like too big, too far away to lock off. And so you have to get some dynamic movement and you have to hit the hold at the right time. So the fundamentals in that movement are, pulling with your hands at the same time as you're pushing with your feet. You want to focus on the path of your hips. Is it better to have your hips start far away from the wall and then surge in close to the wall as you're moving up? Is it better to have your hips stay close to the wall through the whole movement? Try a bunch of different things, see what works for that particular movement. And then I think a really important thing is accuracy with your hand. And the best tip I can give you on being accurate with your hand placement is don't move fast. I think I see this a bunch when people move to pockets. Let's say that you're jumping to a pocket. You try to get your hand above the pocket as fast as you can. And then you're sitting there like trying to make micro adjustments with your fingers. And then maybe you finally get your fingers in the pocket and then you're like, ah, and you bottom out your shoulders. I think that it's much better to move your whole arm and just make one stab. Move your whole arm, move slow, move like you're moving to a regular hold, and then just one stab into the pocket or into whatever hold you're going to. Don't rush it.
Dude, I have thought of Nathaniel as a specifically good accurate climber, like specifically in pocket stabs.
It's the kendama.
Stabs, like... It's the kendama.
Pro tip.
Your footwork is insane for sure. Like that's for me a huge thing that I look at is a lot of your footwork and your footwork accuracy is also really, really good. But yeah, that accuracy tip is really good. And I think just practicing it over and over again, of course, you learn the nuances that happen. But yeah, cool to hear about the timing fundamentals. That is awesome.
Okay, Kyle O'Meara, your boy. He pointed out that you started climbing when you were 10, you've been climbing for over 15 years. And he was wondering what's the most inspiring climbing feat you've ever witnessed in person.
Oh, I'll start off with, I have two of them, if that's all right. And they're both competition. The first one was, Meiringen World Cup, Bouldering World Cup. And I believe it was 2019. You guys can probably correct me on this, but it was the finals that had the yellow crack as the final boulder, men's four. And Adam Andra was the last to go. And we watched five people not know how to crack climb. And then Adam climbed it like the 5.11 crack that it was. And it was like... Oh, it was just the most insane thing. And it wasn't even that impressive because it wasn't hard for Adam, but it was just such, he just laid down the hammer, man. It was so cool. But then the most,
it was insane how easy it looked.
Yeah,
it looked so
it
easy.
When was. It was a 5'11" crack. Yeah. But then the most like impactful thing for me that I've ever seen in person was watching Sean Bailey win the Salt Lake World Cup, in person. And that was in 2021. And that final boulder, it was like such a sick move. You were on two holds and the final hold was like 6 feet away and you had to dyno and then step off of volume. And he caught this thing, and as soon as he caught it, he knew he had it because he turned around to the crowd and just full primal yell. And you know, I'm good friends with Sean, so it was, I'll never forget that moment. It was so sick.
That was objectively one of the best climbing comp moments of all time.
Yeah.
That was objectively one of the best. That was amazing. Yeah.
Oh, seriously.
And a crazy move. You're right. Like, I mean, nobody looked close really on it for a while. Mm-hmm. We're just watching, and it started to become like my read on that situation was like, I was like, it started to become like this boulder wouldn't get sent, to be honest. And then it's like, I started to feel a lot of the same things about watching you in those, you know, kind of open nationals finals that we were talking about earlier, where like specifically there was another similar one where there was this, like, I think it was like this blue pinch boulder, was the last boulder, and nobody was really close on it at all. And then Kai got like really close on it.
Yeah.
And did it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like insane. And then you came out and flashed it and it was like, oh, like, and basically what I'm saying is like, going from watching competitors, good competitors in finals, just like not solve a boulder, like not even get close. And then somebody that you're like, you start to like feel that the climb is going to get sent. First of all, like you start feeling, especially when Sean went out, you're like, you have a mixture of anticipation of this person's going to do it, but then also a mixture of just like, probably not, right? Like there's no way. And then when it actually happens, it has to be one of the most special feelings.
Yeah.
Where you're like, everything just told us that if this person was not going to do it, and this person just happens to do it like first try most of the time.
Yeah.
It's the most insane thing.
It's the most
insane. I love
insane
it. Thing. Oh, what a good moment.
And it's why difficult routes are so important, because you don't get that moments when it's like, you know, three or four people send every boulder.
Dude, that makes me think of this thing I heard you say about, I think it was your finals for bouldering in the Olympics, and you said that you were psyched to be the first person to climb in finals because you wanted to put pressure on the other competitors. Like that's like a really interesting way to focus on yourself instead of everyone else. I thought that was just like, that really stood out as like strong mental game, right? It's like, it's about me, not about how others are doing. And it also makes me think that you'll be really good on doing first ascents, because first ascents require this belief and this commitment to yourself versus like, well, I know this move goes. I mean, like, you know, here's videos of people doing it. And so that really stood out to me, and that you reminded me of that, hearing that story. All right, guys. I mean, the only one that I want to ask last, even though you kind of already answered it, is do you have any climbs on your just like must do bucket list? You know, like those climbs you saw, you know, I'm sure now I'm going to say Defying Gravity is one, and you know, this extension to the route you already put up. But do you have any other climbs that just you've seen media footage that you just like, I literally have these memories of where I'll see a movie and I'm just like, I make a new, you know, note on my phone. It's like, okay, like that's going on the bucket list. Do you have a bucket list?
Yeah, I got a pretty extensive one, mostly of just like saved posts on Instagram of like boulders or routes that I see that look really cool. So that one's not very curated. More of just like a, hopefully I get around to these things, but there's one down in South Africa. It's so silly. It's a dyno. It's on the Nutzel boulder, and it's really hard. I tried it a lot back in like 2018 when I went, and I got close, but I didn't stick it. And I think it's going to be like a V13 or V14 dyno. So I still remember it. I'm still coming back for it. Yeah.
And it hasn't been done.
No, it hasn't been done. It's been tried by, wow, it's been tried by Jimmy Webb, Jan Hoyer, myself, and Charlie Baron. So all really good dinosaurs.
Damn.
Yeah.
Cool.
But awesome. Yeah, other than that.
Awesome to see that battle go down.
Yeah, I don't have much other than that off the top of my head.
Well, I think Defying Gravity is a pretty reasonable one to have up high on the list, and it's not too far from us. You don't even have to buy a ticket to Africa. And with that beautiful boulder in mind, let's call it on the podcast. You guys, this was so good. Nathaniel, it was just a privilege. Loved getting to really dive in deep on what it's really like out on the mat. And just looking forward to all the content you create too, because I really think that creative outlet in Twitch could be a big change in how we all consume climbing. So thank you for that. Thank you for taking the time to come on, and just really appreciate it, man. That was wonderful.
Hey,
thanks for the time, man.
Thank you guys as well. I had a lot of fun. We got some serious juices flowing. I'm psyched. I'm going to be thinking about this for the next month. Yeah.
Yes, that's what we want to hear. Yeah. Thanks a ton for coming on, man. Yeah. Appreciate you a ton.
Cool.
All right, take care, guys.
See you guys.
Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.